This is Indie Book Publishing. Indie Book Publishing is a show about new books and the authors who wrote them. It's an opportunity for prospective readers to hear directly from the writers, to hear what inspired them to write and publish, and to hear all the inside details about their books. And now, Indie Book Publishing.
Greetings for Indie Book Publishing, Balboa Press. This is J. Douglas Barker. The book is a very straightforward title, On Time. The author, Dr. Carol N. Hildebrand, has since writing this book, deceased. And joining me, though, is one of her closest relatives, a close friend, and someone that can talk about her story and her history and why this book was written, Lois Brown. Welcome to the program, Lois.
Thank you.
This is a relatively short read, about 100 pages or so. I'm curious about the title and what the aspects of Dr. Hildebrand's life, made this something that she was obsessed with, time. I mean, we all are, but why this?
Right. Well, I think that the author was addressing the age-old problem of time scarcity versus time abundance. And I think it became so obvious to her at some point in her life that she had fallen victim to feeling that, as I think most people do, and probably most of the readers would feel, that life is filled with time scarcity. And I think maybe she was aware and talked often about the taskmaster called time, feeling she never had enough time to do all that she did. And I think what happened as she began to look at this, she had been a very productive person. She had worked at various service jobs her entire life to get one degree after the other. She had not only become a dentist and finished dental school at a university in Philadelphia, but after that she also got a master's degree and for some time not only ran a very successful periodontal practice in Philadelphia, but at the same time for a few years taught dentistry at the university, at the Temple University.
That's incredible.
So she certainly used, and I believe that one purpose in writing the book, at some point I believe she looked at how much she had crammed into her life, and I think the book is kind of I don't think she regrets that because she loved her work, and she was a hardworking person, and it suited her. And so I think over the years, though, she became gave so much time to her patients and her staff and her work that she began to feel that she had become a victim of time.
Hmm.
And I believe that's why the book, how the book evolved. I see caveats in the book to others, to the readers, talking about the difference between being efficient and being effective. I mean, it's not even a matter of how much time we have, because we all have the same amount of time, to quote her. And she just felt that that we all at some point use and abuse time.
She was the type of person that kept lists and outlines of things she needed to accomplish in a given day. Was that a good way to describe how she conducted her life?
Absolutely. Everything was organized. She was a tremendously organized person.
And as an organized person, in knowing her and having been around her, is there anything that indicated maybe from her early childhood that maybe set her on this path of needing to control time?
Yes, I as I said, she was a striver and a great student and loved to achieve, and she came from a working class family that required her to do many jobs in order to put herself through all these to put herself through school and get all these degrees. As I said, even after she got all the dental degrees, she got a master's in order to teach. So I think it was the striving. It was coming from a family that valued these things. So I don't think she actually wrote the book as a regret that she had felt at some point, was feeling at this point that she had misused some of her time. I think she just began to explore that difference between efficiency and effectiveness. The book gives caveats about spending your time thoughtlessly and rushing to make life happen. I think she felt that efficiency had become king in her life and she was its slave. And I see the caveats in the book to other people. I think it was not a regret so much as trying to tell others that you can so easily become a slave to time. And, the regrets were waiting in the rearview mirror, maybe, but.
Absolutely. She has included some, we'll call them worksheets or work pages where people can kind of analyze or kind of take a look at their life and decide, whether they're making good choices. Is that a part of maybe her teaching style? Did she incorporate those types of things?
Yes, absolutely. Always the teacher. She felt that it was good to pass on what she learned, and she felt that she had, as I said, used her time effectively and efficiently, I guess. But she wanted to use it more effectively. I think that's the distinction. I don't think she was, the purpose of the book was to designate a right or wrong way to use your time, but I think she just began to feel that just packing everything that you had to do into one day may be efficient, but it may not be effective. She began to realize that here she was working two or three careers, but perhaps she could have used her time better and made more money by finding a way to work less, working more effectively, I think is what she thought, what she is trying to transmit in the book.
Yes, I noticed that she also highlights the work of Napoleon Hill, who has written a very well-known book titled Think and Grow Rich. Is financial success something that she was wanting to pass along to others? She has in here several laws that she thinks are part of the universe or that she thought were part of the universe, and she talks about the law of perpetual transmission, the law of relativity, the law of vibration, polarity, rhythm. Cause and effect. These are things that maybe make a lot of sense to most people. She even has one that's a little bit unique, the law of gender. What was her embracing of those concepts?
I think the choices that she made were, as I said, they were more efficient than effective. And I think that was a big decision for her. And she began to realize that you had to take charge of the time in your life. It was important to her making money was important to her. She wanted to have a career where she could make money. And I think that comes from any of us who've come from families that aren't among the rich. And I think she began to realize that her efforts and her studying and her work could create that for her. And as time went on, she began to realize that you need to take charge of that in terms of not just doing everything to make money, but that you might be able to find a way to make money without wasting your time, essentially.
Absolutely. That's good advice for any age and any philosophy. The title on time certainly tells the story itself. What is the reader going to get from this, do you think? How would you introduce this book to someone that maybe does not know of Dr. Carol Hildebrand and doesn't know of her philosophy, but really wants to get a handle on a better approach to life and time management? How would you describe this book to them?
I think the warnings or caveats that she posts in the book are to help people realize, and I think most of us do realize, that we walk around feeling there's enough time for what we have to do. And I think the major message here is that you just have to choose the things that are most important. And we always are talking. I would say the big message is that most of the readers will recognize that they are always feeling they don't have enough time. And the conclusion that she came to, obviously, in her life, which I think she wanted to transfer to the book or to offer to the reader through the book. I think she came to know that life is a constant battle between time scarcity and time abundance, and she felt that she had not put enough boundaries on her own time, and she was beginning to reevaluate about whether she might have taken more downtime for herself and for her family and loved ones. I don't think that means she regrets her devotion to her career, but I think she wants to remind people that we always think we need more time, and I would say the major message in this book is that there is not more time, and that time is not good, not bad. It's our perception of time. And it seems, as for all of us, as for her, all of us feel that time goes fast when we're doing something we love, but drags when we're doing something we don't like.
So true, so true.
She felt we were kind of always spinning back and forth between the future and the now. And the bottom line message, I think, to the reader is that she's reminding us that we only have the now. We think about the future, what we will do in the future, and try to compare it to our past. The truth is, what we only have left is the now in terms of time. I would say that's the bottom line message, that that you can't go around worrying about getting everything in the world done, that you you have to deal with what you can do now and deal with we only have a certain amount of time.
Well, beautiful.
And we all get the same amount of time, just a lifetime, and we have to choose what we want to do with that lifetime.
Lois, if you had a way to recap and maybe outline her philosophy of life, how would you do so?
Well, I think that the author began to realize that that we can take charge of the time in our lives, and she felt that the mind is movement, that the every body movement that you make comes from your mind, and she wants to have us think about that, meaning that there's a power within you. That lets you, will let you control your behavior and the thoughts that you choose, and can make it more resourceful. Your conscious mind, she says, is the power center, where the real free will resides. So what she wants to convey, I think, to the reader is that when you mindlessly make decisions that are tied to your habit, then the efficiency factor appears. And it may appeal to your unconscious mind, but your conscious mind can make your time count. If you use that power that the conscious mind gives you, you can think more about how you want to make your time count, and maybe actually not worry about the number of things you do, but worry about what you can do that works best for you and still allows you time for the things that you love and want.
Beautifully put. Beautifully put. The title, again, is On Time, and I will mention to the readers and those who will read this book, there is probably a total of 10 to 15 pages at least of action guide, which you can interact with the author and reflect on certain parts of your life that you may want to address and change. Talks about consciousness, about things that you'd like to change in your attitude. Very positive things that will reinforce to you a path of choice that will positively impact you. Again, the title is On Time, the author, Dr. Carol, with an E, N. Hildebrand. My guest today who has shared her story is Lois Brown. Thank you, Lois, for joining me. Where can my listeners get a copy of this book?
It's going to be at Barnes & Noble, and it will be on Amazon also. It can be ordered online. And there's a hardback and a soft cover, and I think at two different prices, but it will be available at those places online and at Barnes & Noble.
Well, thank you for sharing her story today and sharing the story of the importance of time, of course, something that we're aware of, but maybe don't have the practical tools to address. Thank you again for joining me and sharing her story. The title, again, is On Time, Dr. Carol N. Hildebrand, the author. Thank you again. Have a great day.
Thanks.
For Indie Book Publishing, Balboa Press, this is J. Douglas Barker.
Listening to Indie Book Publishing. And we'll be right back after these messages.
Have you heard? The pages of American Patchwork and Quilting magazine come to life on our new weekly online radio show, American Patchwork and Quilting. Join Pat Sloan, our blogging and quilt designer host, as she talks about the latest trends, ideas, and inspirations. Her guests include quilt pattern designers, authors, quilt shop owners, and our editors. All quilters, just like you. Call in with your questions. Get quilting tips from industry experts. Learn about free patterns. Hear behind-the-scenes stories from our magazines, American Patchwork and Quilting, Quilt Sampler, and Quilts and More. Get the scoop on free stuff. And find out more about the best independent quilt shops in North America. To listen to a live show, tune in Monday at 4 p.m. Eastern. Just log on to allpeoplequilt.com/radio. To hear past shows, go to iTunes and search for American Patchwork and Quilting Radio. We hope you'll join us because we know that quilting changes everything.
Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host.
Greetings for Indie Book Publishing, Lulu Press. This is J. Douglas Barker. The title of the book is Where's the Salt? With a question mark. And my author who joins me from the Carolinas is Stephen S. Purdy. Welcome, sir, to the program.
Thank you, and good to hear from you.
Well, this is a book that is a relatively short read. There must have been some inspiration behind it, and the title itself is unique. Where did the inspiration for the title come from, and what motivated you to write this?
The story is a bit of a long one. I've heard people speak in sermons and just regular talks about things in the Bible where people would be reading it, and then you listen to someone say, "Did you see what else was there?" And I happen to be just thinking about Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, and I've been trained as a physicist and chemist. I've handled chemicals and been in laboratories pretty much a lot of my life. And it sort of hit me like a ton of bricks when rereading the Jesus' words about salt. And if, in essence, that salt would lose its savor. And I'm thinking to myself, wow, okay, nobody's ever really talked about it. And it involves the concept of how do you corrupt salt so it's not salty.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost impossible to do that with a chemical. You can try in the laboratory, but folks have discovered that you can dilute salt down to an awful low percentage. And it will your taste buds will still detect salt.
Interesting.
It's there. It's really, really hard to conceive of how would you destroy salt so that it wouldn't be able to do any of the things that folks normally expect salt to do. And in the little book, it could have been a huge book, but I figured, you know, not everybody wants to learn all of the different things that salt can do, except for the major ones. But it does so many things. And if all of a sudden it couldn't, there are so many processes and so many things in our life today that would actually come to a halt and stop and cease to be good if that happened. And I never really heard anybody talk about it. And it became a burden on my heart to dig into it and possibly try to come up with something that might explain it some.
Because of your career background, then, this became more than just an observation of Matthew chapter 5, which is the Sermon on the Mount. It became a research project as well.
It did, and it's not just research, but philosophically speaking, how do you take something that has basically been a standard without fail for thousands of years, and how do you ruin it? And I tried to explore it a little bit, and it happens that Jesus used something that people would possibly just stop maybe at the time and wonder, because at the time that Jesus was speaking, salt was an extremely expensive commodity.
Yes.
It was hard to get. You'd think, why? You know, you've got the right next to the Mediterranean Ocean, which is full of salt. But getting good salt back then meant to find mined salt. It had to come from a salt mine or something like that. They didn't have the purified, if it rains, it pours kind of salt that mm-hmm. we have today. It was mined and probably better for you, but it was still a combination of sodium and chlorine.
And what did
it's
you
interesting.
What did you hope to achieve by the content of your book? Again, it's a short read, but you must have had somebody in mind that you wanted to inspire by the discoveries that you have shared.
I did. It was people who don't realize that they are being called on to be salt in this world. In other words, to stand up for what they know is right and to not back away from it, to be what they're supposed to be. Salt is very hard to change, and it's interesting. It has a cubic crystalline structure. And even if you, no matter how small you grind salt, it retains that same cubic structure. And we're called on to maintain our character, our relationship to God, all of those things, we're being called on it. And if that is destroyed, that affects not just our own lives, but the lives of people all around us who might be expecting us to do the right thing.
You have also highlighted some, you know, obvious things that people know from experience, things like salt melts ice, but there is a philosophical interpretation of that as well.
That's right. It's being pure can melt the ice that forms over someone's heart and mind to prevent them from actually trying to listen to what God might be wanting to speak to them.
You have also highlighted salt as a standard reference system. Salt has power. Salt even puts out fire. I had not really thought about that, but there's some other things that you mentioned. Salt has there's a warning in salt. The book itself, how long did it take to write, Stephen?
It took quite a while because I didn't want it to be a long, drawn-out affair. I didn't want it to be too technical. I didn't want it to be too preachy. I wanted it to be something written to allow someone to grasp the concept, hopefully without a lot of effort, and get the message. The most effective things that I've come across in my life are not the biggest ones. They're the smallest ones, where the idea comes across. And I actually had to struggle with it a little bit because it would have been easy just to possibly consider doing a few pages, but it wouldn't have really fleshed it out. So I tried to strike a balance between getting the message across and not being like boring and extra long and having all kinds of extra things on it. I mean, if you start researching salt, you could write volumes and volumes enough to fill a small library.
What was the warning that James Madison gave in 1787 that you highlight?
I think I'd have to go back and actually look at my own book for that one. Do you happen to have that with you?
I do have it in front of me. He was the fourth president of the United States and author of the Federalist Papers, and he had a lot to say about morality and principle, and this ties together. He's quoted as saying, "No man can be a competent legislature who does not add up to an upright intention and a sound judgment and a certain degree of knowledge of the subject on which he is legislating. The truth is that all men have power, ought to be mistrusted." That certainly works today in our contemporary society, doesn't it?
It certainly does. It certainly does. It has to. You cannot ignore what is happening around you, and a person who has lost the ability to do that is a person who is beginning to lose their grip on salt and can't be counted on to give a good answer.
You have, again, focused on the background of salt and its importance in society and how it impacts our lives and can impact our culture. You also have dealt with the philosophical side and have brought in other quotes from other people like Benjamin Franklin and others who were the founding principles of the United States Constitution. So this is a little broader range than just focusing on Chapter 5 of Matthew and the Beatitudes. You could also say this book would be a great reference point for Bible teachers and care groups. Is that also something you had in mind?
I would be delighted if they would use it. I felt during the, you asked me how long it took. During that entire time, it was a concept I could not get rid of. You may know that I'm not an author. This is my first book. Writing isn't something I do for recreation, but I could not shake an urgent prompting to go back and work on the book and put it into print, give it birth. I would like the concept, be delighted if that concept would be shared.
Beautiful. Well, thank you for sharing your story. And the title again is Where's the Salt? Stephen,
yes,
have you been able to get any responses from people that have read your book? What's the response been?
I did get some responses from some people. I sent a copy of one of them to Franklin Graham and got a very nice note back from him. I also sent a copy to Dr. Dobson and his organization. I didn't get an answer from him, but I got an answer saying that they really appreciated it. I got a very good old friend, and I only say old because we're both a little bit, but I've known him for 40 years, and he said he couldn't say enough nice things about it. So I'm feeling very encouraged that it does, and a few other people, just friends that I know where I live, really liked it.
My author, Stephen S. Purdy, P-U-R-D-Y, has been my guest. Stephen, there are listeners who will want to get a copy of this. How do they do so?
They can get a copy of it by going, I believe, to Amazon. They can go to lulu.com. They can Google Where's the Salt, and they will find several different booksellers that will be able to sell it to them, either in print form or in ebook form.
And usually Amazon will have an excerpt on their page if it's shown out there, so that might be also something that would be of interest to my listeners. They can do a search on the title again, Where's the Salt, or under your name, Stephen with a V, E-N-S, Purdy, P-U-R-D-Y. They also can request this from their local booksellers by name, and they can order it in on their behalf as well. Thank you for joining me today. Is there another book in the future at this point, or is that something that you're kind of waiting to see what will happen with Where's the Salt?
I'm probably going to be waiting to see a little bit of what happens with the book and also whether I receive prompting to go ahead and come up with something additional.
Well, thank you for joining me today and sharing your story.
Thank you very much, sir. Pleasure talking with you.
My pleasure. For Indie Book Publishing, Lulu Press, this is J. Douglas Barker.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages.
It's the Fitness Minute with fitness expert Annette Hammond.
When your focus is to lose weight or maintain your present weight, exercising effectively to burn the most calories is crucial. You want to give yourself every advantage to burn as many calories as possible. One good tip is to do your strength training exercises standing up so you can keep your heart rate up. Another tip is to perform multi-joint exercises when you can. For example, as you're doing a forward lunge, add bicep curls while you're coming up from the lunge. Another example is to execute a wide squat, and as you're coming up from the squat, perform a shoulder press. By doing these multi-joint exercises, you're putting more demands on your body, keeping your heart rate up, and working more muscles at the same time. The goal is to burn the most calories during that workout. I'm Annette Hammond. To hear other fitness and weight loss tips, visit our website at AnnetteHammond.com.
Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host.
The title of the book, Leadership Boosters, How to Make an Immediate Positive Impact on Those You Lead. And the author is T. Scott Graham. And Scott joins us now on Indie Book Publishing. And this interview is brought to you by Lulu Publishing. Hello, Scott.
Hello.
Well, great
to have
you. Well, I'm doing great. And you've got an incredible resume. I'm looking at it. Talk about 30 years of leadership, teaching, consulting, training, coaching, speaking, and researching. So you've been down this road for a long time, and thus the book, right? You wanted to share how to best impact people who are leaders.
Exactly. You're right. 30 years, a pretty diverse map that I've followed to kind of get me to this point of writing this book. And all of my experiences, good and bad, have all helped me form my thoughts and my ideas of things that I share with people, both in the academic setting, and I've taught at three different universities, leadership, and certainly with a lot of organizations, both for-profit and not-for-profit, education, government, and I'm always learning. I'm continually learning. I think that's key, and that's part of why this book I felt was important to put out there. I've got my hands on a lot of leadership books. I own a lot of leadership books. They're, you know, all have their own strengths and pieces of information that have found useful, some more than others. But I just couldn't, there was not something out there like what I've written, because a lot of it is hard to get your brain around as to, okay, so that sounds great. How do I do it? It's not just, okay, it's good information, but how do I do this stuff?
Right.
How do I get better at this? So that's what I tried to do. And it's certainly not an exhaustive list of things that one can do and should do, but it's a start. And I've broken it into 10 modules, 10 chapters, if you will. And they're all laid out the same format so people can jump into anywhere they find that the information could be helpful to them. It's not a start at the front and read your way through it. It's pick the area that you think will be most helpful to you and go right to it.
So 10 leadership skill boosters, as you call them, leadership skill boosters. And you come, again, from an incredible background of retired lieutenant colonel from the United States Air Force, where you were a B-52 crew member. So that's so unique. And, of course, then right now, you're currently an assistant professor teaching at the Ohio State University.
That's right. You got to throw that.
I know.
I
know. So I wanted to emphasize the Ohio State University. Well, let's kind of look at some of these skills, these leadership skill boosters that you are advocating. And before we do that, though, let's talk about how you wrote this. This is written more like you're sitting down with us and talking to us.
Well, that's the only way I really know how to write, because, you know, I own a lot of books, read a lot of books, have a lot of books that I've used in my teaching and training and consulting. And, you know, the ones that are written more conversational, I find I just relate to it better. I feel like the person who wrote it is sitting there with me, talking to me over coffee. One of my favorite authors is Ken Blanchard. He wrote The 1 Minute Manager. That's the one many people have heard of, but he's written many other books, and he's been around a long time. And I like the way he writes. It's the same kind of thing. So I've sort of modeled it, not so much right after his more stories, but just that informational, kind of informal, conversational tone. And that's what I tried to do here, just like I'm sitting with you and we're having a conversation and we're talking and we're chatting about something that people either are struggling with or just want to get better at. And I'll just tell you this, Steve, I was fortunate enough in one of my academic, not at Ohio State, but I was at another institution prior to this. And I was fortunate enough to be granted a sabbatical, which, you know, most jobs, you don't get those, you know, when you get a year off to write. And that's what I did. That's when this thing was born, because I had the time and I could take give it the attention it needed and work with it. And that was about 5 years ago, quite honestly. And then from the last 5 years, I've taken the book in its draft form, and I've used it in training. I've used it in my teaching, and I've taken a lot of the input that I've gotten from those that I've taught to fold it back in to make it even better, in my view. I think it was an improvement over what I started with, because I got the user involved and tell me how this works for you. It's like, well, I didn't really understand that part. Talk to me about it. So I got a lot of input to try to make it better.
So this Leaders User's Manual, as you call it, is simple, to the point, useful, realistic, meaningful. Let's kind of jump in here and talk about a few of these leadership skill boosters, just to give everyone an idea of how you address these sometimes mind-boggling kind of subjects, because they're so critical and a lot of times people don't know how to change. So let's just start with your first one, your first booster. Know yourself. How do you help me by reading your book to know myself?
Okay, well, I think I need to back up just a hair and tell folks why that first one was the first one. One of the things I learned many moons ago is, and I learned this by working with and chatting with a lot of the smart folks at the Center for Creative Leadership out of Greensboro, North Carolina. And if people want to look at what they do, ccl.org. Okay, I use them all the time. They're really, really good at what they do as far as advancing the whole knowledge world of what's going on in the world of leadership and leading successfully. So years ago, when I was down there in some workshop, and I was talking to somebody, and he shared with me some research on the number one difference maker in successful leaders and those that, as they call it, derail or become unsuccessful or never reach the level of success they want, is self-awareness. So if you don't understand your own strengths, your own weaknesses, let's just say it what it is. Some people are just have some areas they're weak in or terrible in. And if you don't know that, then how do you know where to start and what to do? So it's really a two-step process. It's knowing yourself, so knowing what your strengths are, knowing what you bring to this thing called leadership, and knowing what you don't. And then number two, what do you do about it? I mean, okay, so now I've got some information. I've asked people to give me feedback. They gave it to me. Now what do I do with that information? So it's not just knowing about yourself. And I share this in that first chapter. It's not just knowing about yourself, knowing your strengths, knowing your weaknesses, but then knowing, what do I do? How do I do this now? Now that I've got this good information to help guide me, what do I do next? And that's kind of where the rest of the boosters come in, because they're big areas. They're not all of the areas you could possibly think of, but things like coaching people, emotional intelligence, I call it people skills. That's what many of the experts who write on the subject of emotional intelligence call it, the people skills we need. And unfortunately, I think those are eroding in today's world of work. And one big reason is one of the other boosters is, how do we leverage technology, not let technology kind of overpower us, but we use it to our benefit as we lead other people. So, you know, the know yourself is the starter, and that's probably the best place for people to start, is just go there, because each of the 10 things that you assess yourself on are then laid out in the follow-on 9 boosters. And I'll just tell everyone, this is the way this book is laid out. You have a chapter, a booster, I call it, and it's focused on a particular content area or topic area of leadership. And then it's laid out by, here's some content, here's some background of why this is important, give you a little, you know, background so you understand the basis for why I'm saying this is so critical. Like, how do you coach people? How do you communicate effectively? How do you deal with change in the workplace? So it's not just getting that content. That's what you can get in any book. You can Google the content. But then it's, let's look at some sample cases that come from my own experiences of how does this play out? How do people do this well? How do people not do this well? Just short little stories, cases. And then I have a self-assessment, usually a 10-item, a Likert scale, which is 1 through 5, you know, strongly agree or strongly disagree. You assess yourself on these 10 areas. And then the second part of that assessment is you give it to others who know you well enough to fill it out. They fill it out on you, and then they get a third page, which is some qualitative, some sort of open-ended questions that they could fill out, and then you take all of that, look at it. That helps you know yourself in that particular area. And then in these chapters, I give you 10 ways to do this better. Now, all 10 aren't going to work for everybody. Let's say I'm looking at how to be a more effective coach, and I look at these 10 ways to be a more effective coach, to coach somebody to be successful. I might look at two of them and go, yeah, I could do those two. I think that would really fit me and the people that I'm working with. The other eight, not so much. And I say, okay, then you got two. Start with one. Start working on it. And that's a value add. That's a plus. Somebody got something out of the book. They learned something. They can do something with the information that they have. So to me, it makes sense. And the people that I've tested it on over the last 5 years, this book prior to it becoming a book, have told me it makes sense, you know, the format, the flow. So that's the feedback I've gotten, and I hope people who read it find it useful to them.
Can you give us an example of someone you were first, when you first met, you thought, wow, this person's never going to change? Can you give us an example that he did change or she did change and really made progress with working with people and leading people?
Yeah, I can. I'm going to start with one, though, that just jumps out in my head, of someone who didn't do it right, okay? I was hired, this was probably about 8 or 9 years ago, to go into this scientific organization to help this scientist who had been recently promoted to manager, to help him, to coach him to be more successful, because he was a great scientist, award-winning, great at what he did. He was a horrible boss, horrible supervisor of these 12 people that, oh, by the way, he used to be their equal. They would work together, and then come Monday, he was promoted to boss, supervisor, and he just completely sort of had this change of personality. He just didn't know how to do it well. He didn't know how to, you know, supervise. He didn't know how to get feedback. He didn't know how to get praise. He didn't do a lot of things well. So they hired me to coach him. And within 10 minutes of meeting with him, it was crystal clear. He didn't want me there. He didn't think he needed me there. He wasn't going to do anything different. He didn't care what I said. He wanted to do it. So that was a very short conversation. It was a very short consulting engagement, because I told the person who hired me, it's never going to work. He has a horrible attitude about even me being there to help him. He doesn't think he needs help. And until he does, you're wasting your money, and I'm wasting my time. So I bailed. And I found out later, they tried another coach who also realized the same thing, and they finally put him back where he belonged, which is not in a leadership role. And he was happy. So sometimes people get promoted and they shouldn't be, and they promoted for the wrong reasons. Maybe they were in the job a long time and they were next up, you know. But so it should be a kind of a mutual thing. People raise their hand to be a manager or a leader because they want to do it, not because they are forced to do it. That's when it works best. But anyway, back to your question about a successful example. Okay, I'll think about wow, I could list a bunch, because there are a bunch. But let me focus on the area of change. Okay, I was working with this large manufacturing organization, and they were going through a lot of changes. But they had a new HR director, human resources director, and he was struggling a bit. And he realized he needed help. So he went to his boss, the CEO, and said, you know, I could use an executive coach or a coach, somebody to sort of kind of look at me from the outside looking in and give me some ideas, because it's just, I'm not really clicking with my team. I can't get them to change and all that. So what I did was I met with him. We did an assessment, not using the ones in this book, but another one that I thought fit him. And I did the 360 assessment, which is really getting a kind of a 360-degree view of yourself by asking a lot of people, your bosses, your peers, the people that report to you, people outside the organization. So I spent a lot of time and money putting that together for him. We sat down, and first he didn't want to believe the results because they weren't glowing. But after he got over the shock of that, he rolled up his sleeves and he said, okay, I'm ready to do the hard work to change in order to be a more successful leader. So we worked together closely for about 6 months. I would meet with him once every few weeks for about an hour over coffee and then say, how's it going? You know, give me some examples of things that are working well, things that aren't, what have you tried? And we just had the conversation. And we stayed in touch over that period of time. And he actually wanted to change. Unlike that first dude, the scientist guy who didn't want to change and he wasn't about to even consider doing anything differently, this guy really wanted to be successful. And what happened? 2 years later, I stayed with him for about 6 months, then sort of left. I stayed in touch with him, email every now and then, but he eventually was promoted to CEO of another organization. So he wanted to learn. He wanted to get better. He wanted to see where he was struggling and work on those things. And he did. So he was one of the success stories that I'm very proud of because if he wouldn't have wanted to do it, I would have been just like I was with the first guy. It wouldn't have gone anywhere. So people have to care. People have to want to change.
Yes. Change doesn't come easy, as we all know personally, but T. Scott Graham, he is the author of his book, Leadership Boosters, How to Make an Immediate Positive Impact on Those You Lead. Scott, what's the best way to get your book?
LeadershipBoosters.com.
LeadershipBoosters.com. That's simple, everyone. Well, Scott?
Yeah, or Amazon. If you just type Leadership Boosters in Amazon or Barnes & Noble, you can order it that way. You can order it via paperback or ebook. I'm old school, I guess. I like paperback because I like to use the sheets in there, like the assessments, paper, and, you know, make copies and all that. But certainly you can do it electronically and, you know, bring yourself into the new world and get the ebook and read it on Kindle or whatever and use photocopy the sheets in there. They're all photocopiable. Use them however you see fit to help you.
Well, thank you so much, Scott, for joining us on Indie Book Publishing.
Thanks for having me, and I hope people get some real value out of this book. That's why I wrote it.
And this interview has been brought to you by Lulu Publishing.
You've been listening to Indie Book Publishing. Join us again next week at noon Eastern.